welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 11th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, $20 million bond issue on ballot Tuesday to fund fiber network for municipal broadband. Almost 20 years after approving the creation of a municipal broadband utility, residents of Waterloo can vote on how to fund a fiber network backbone for their city. Polls will be open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday, so voters can weigh in on public measures to issue $20 million in general obligation bonds for the broadband system. Passage requires 60% approval by voters. "This is not a referendum. That's already proven," said Mayor Quentin Hart, referring to the 2005 vote approving the creation of the broadband utility. "This is a way to lower interest dollars to go towards this project," he said. "If not approved, we'll continue to look at other options. This is just the ability to use the financial tool before us." Issuing general obligation bonds is a way governments can raise money for projects. These bonds are backed by the government's ability to pay its property owners, if necessary, in order to pay bondholders. Maggie Berger, a senior vice president at Spear Financial, a local municipal advising company, said there is no plan for any tax increase based on the bonds. "We had conversations with the city and council, and their intent is not to raise taxes," Berger said. Andy Van Fleet, a board member for the city's telecommunication board, said when the broadband utility generates revenue, that revenue will be used to repay the bonds. He noted Cedar Falls Utilities, which includes broadband in its services, last year had a net income of $4.88 million. "Waterloo has twice the homes Cedar Falls does," Van Fleet said. "You can pencil that out and realize the profit can stay in Waterloo." Some city residents are wary of using general obligation bonds, saying they fear that taxes will eventually go up. One person backing that statement is Chip Baltimore, a senior fellow at Taxpayers Protection Alliance and a former Iowa state legislator. "If you're coming at the first stage and use $20 million of GO bond money for this, then it tells me that when you do the other stages, you're going to come back and do it again," Baltimore said. "Everybody pays those taxes, but everyone may not want to use those things, and if it fails, it's on the property taxpayers to pay the debt." At a recent city council meeting, Steve Nadell, the attorney with Allers & Cooney PC, said that if any utilities are going to use the fiber backbone for their purposes, each utility usage would require a public hearing at a council meeting. If approved, the bonds would be used to design, acquire, construct, install, and equip all or part of a fiber optic backbone and fiber to the premises broadband communication system. The backbone project, which would connect 100 miles of fiber optic cable to over 100 sites across Waterloo, is expected to cost just over $29 million. The fiber to the premises half of the project connects broadband to homes in the city. That more extensive project is expected to cost $86 million. Waterloo received $31.24 million from the Federal American Rescue Plan that can be used for broadband purposes. Van Fleet said the project has taken around 4 years to plan. The next step is to send designs to companies to see how it would be constructed and then receive bids from those companies. Baltimore argues that the cost could go higher due to rising prices of construction and materials. The project comes after a study done by Magellan Advisors of Denver, Colorado. The firm conducted a survey of 2,727 people in Waterloo. The top concerns found from the survey were reliability, price, and speed of current internet services. The median download speed was 75.26 megabits per second. The upload speed was 22.42 megabits per second. Van Fleet said that the broadband provided by the city would be 1 gigabit for upload and download speed. 1 gigabit per second is 10 times faster than 100 megabits, he noted. There would be no data caps, like an unlimited data plan on a phone. Survey taker said that 1 gigabit per second costs an average of $108.78. Van Fleet said that pricing hasn't been finalized for the city's broadband service, but it would be very competitive if not priced below market. Baltimore said this could be a problem due to the amount of competition in the area. The study done by Magellan noted at least 8 broadband providers in the area. In any other city, we studied for these government-owned systems to work. The consultants are generally saying that they need a market share of 50 to 70%, Baltimore said. If you've got 10 other providers, and for the city to get even 40% of the market, that doesn't seem very likely. Apart from the bonds and the federal funds, Van Fleet said that there are grants that could help pay for the project. It's happening. The train has left the station and is moving forward, Van Fleet said. I'm excited about it, and it feels good to be part of something progressive and beneficial to Waterloo. Waterloo residents can go to any voting centers on Tuesday, no matter their address. These include ISU Extension 3420 University Avenue, Conference Room A, Crossroads Community Church, 3622 Hammond Avenue, Mercy One, Kimball, 2055 Kimball Avenue, St. Paul United Methodist Church, 207 West Louise Street, Our Savior's Lutheran Church, 420 Harwood East Entrance, Payne Memorial AME Church, 1044 Mobile Street, Zion Lutheran Church, 810 Kimball Avenue, lower level, and the Cedar Valley Church, 3520 Ansburn Avenue. They can also vote early in person on Monday between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. at the election office and on the second floor of the Blackhawk County Courthouse at 316 East 5th Street. Now let's move on to the article. Iowa City VA working to expand mental health services, fill gaps. 6 years after a Davenport veteran's suicide sparked national attention and calls from members of Congress for an investigation after he was denied inpatient psychiatric care, the Iowa City Veterans Administration Medical Center is planning for a major expansion. Over the past several years, mental health, both in the military and civilian sector, has been recognized as a shortcoming in our medical treatment of individuals. Whether they veterans or civilians, Heath Streck, Associate Director for Operations, said following 9/11 flag-raising ceremony on Friday at Iowa City VA Healthcare System. Streck, though stressed several mental health initiatives and newly approved funding by Congress, will facilitate infrastructure improvements and hiring of additional mental health professionals and social workers to help with workload and increased need. President Joe Biden in June signed the Sergeant Ketchum Rural Veterans Mental Health Act into law. The legislation was named for Sergeant Brandon Ketchum. The 33-year-old served in Iraq and Afghanistan and struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse after serving in the U.S. Marines and the Iowa Army National Guard. He died by suicide in 2016 after being denied inpatient psychiatric care at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Medical Center. The new law, supported by Iowa's congressional delegation, will establish 3 new Department of Veterans Affairs Rural Access Network for Growth Enhancement Program centers, which provide a small team of specialists to meet the needs of rural veterans with serious mental health and daily living issues. It also requires the government Accountability Office to conduct a study and to report on whether the VA has sufficient resources to serve rural veterans who need mental health care that is more intensive than traditional outpatient therapy. The VA's Office Inspector General concluded in a report that while VA staff were not directly to blame for the way Ketchum was treated by the hospital staff, the system could be improved. The psychiatric decision to not admit the patient was within the acceptable practice based on the information available to him at the time, the report states. However, if the admitting psychiatric had been aware of the extent of the patient's psychological struggles, the psychiatrist may have decided to admit the patient. Moreover, the psychiatrist made a good faith effort to re-engage the patient after he abruptly left the session. Streck and Jamie Johnson, public affairs officer, said that Iowa City-based VA Health System is in the process of developing a medical psych unit and plans to develop a community living center in addition to a residential rehabilitation treatment program to fill gaps and meet demand. The VA healthcare system in Iowa City serves veterans and their families in eastern Iowa and western Illinois. About 35% to 40% are enrolled in the VA and receiving treatment. And demand for inpatient mental health care is expected to increase 6.2% by fiscal 2029, according to a VA market recommendation report for Eastern Iowa. The demand for long-term care is expected to increase by 64.9% by fiscal 2029, the report states. Johnson said that demand is mostly driven by the healthcare system's largely aging patient population, who mostly live in rural areas. There is large swaths of veterans out there that just aren't seeking the services that we would really like to have come see us. He said, there are things that we are doing to improve the services or expand the services and offerings to veterans that might fall into that category. The Biden administration announced plans in March to reposition the country's veterans healthcare system to conform to new needs among patients in the coming years, which includes recommendations to build a new 30-bed residential rehabilitation and treatment program to provide mental health services and a partnership to expand long-term care services in a new community living center. Johnson, the public affairs officer for Iowa City VA, said that both projects had been planned for before the report was released. He also noted that the recommendations must still be approved by Congress and Biden early next year. And here's a subheader that says, New Facility. The VA will likely need to identify a new site to construct a standalone VA nursing home for dementia and post-surgical care due to its Iowa City campus being small and landlocked, with a highway on one side and the University of Iowa campus on the other. If the proposal is approved, Johnson said that he anticipates the VA would look to acquire land or partner with another organization in 2024 to lease a site to expand long-term care services. That is in the preliminary stages, and that's going to be a little further out, Johnson said. Second subheader, rehab treatment. Currently, Iowa City VA patients must travel to St. Cloud, Minnesota, or Des Moines to receive treatment under a rehabilitation and treatment program, which sometimes prevents veterans from engaging in inpatient treatment programs due to the distance, transportation requirements, and separation from family and local support networks, Johnson said. We'll be able to offer extended residential treatment locally without having to transport our patients to other VAs, he said. The program is group-based and focused on helping patients manage chronic disorders, including depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, and other conditions along those lines. Often, patients need weeks, sometimes months, to regain function and be able to recover as best they can. So having an RRTP here will allow us to provide that longer-term care to our acute care unit. Medical, and then another subheader, medical psych unit. While the Iowa City VA healthcare system already has an inpatient mental health unit, its new medical psych unit will add 10 beds for veterans who have an acute medical issue combined with underlying mental health conditions. Johnson said new inpatient unit, which would be housed in the converted administrative office space at the VA hospital, is already being designed and anticipates it will be ready for use in 2024. It would only be the second such unit in the VA healthcare system nationwide, he said. Staff would be specially trained to treat combined illness, such as addiction, depression, and PTSD, and serve as a training site for the University of Iowa Internal Medicine and Psychiatry Program, where resident physicians will be trained in both specialties, Johnson said. Our veteran population is aging, and that aging population also suffers from illness associated with aging, such as mood disorders and dementia, things that can lead to hospitalization. He noted that many hospitals across the region have closed or reduced the census of their inpatient psychiatry units, resulting in more veterans seeking care within the VA due to a shortage of beds. Those things will help us fill those gaps for veterans, Johnson said. Now let's move on to Lee bolsters investigative efforts with 12-person public service team. Lee Enterprises, parent company of The Courier, is shining an investigative reporting spotlight across its 77 daily new markets throughout the country. Lee recently announced its new 12-member public service journalism team, which is made up of veteran reporters who will function as three teams across the company's East, Midwest, and West news regions, respectively. The investigative reporting roles are newly created positions intended to drive public accountability journalism throughout Lee's local news markets, including The Courier. The creation of our public service journalism team strengthens our company's commitment to investigative and data journalism because it's the work that can truly make a difference in the communities we serve, said Jason Adrians, Lee Enterprises Vice President Local News. At Lee Enterprises, we're investigating in local news talents and tools, premium reporting and storytelling, and the development of young journalists. Lee's new public service journalism team members bring expertise in various topical backgrounds, including public safety, public health, government, social justice, and the environment. The regional public service journalism team will assist reporters in local markets with access to public records, track taxpayer money and government spending, examine data related to health, crime, and safety issues, and serve as watchdogs for their communities across the country. If in their previous reporting roles, both inside Lee newsrooms and in other news markets, these team members' work has helped free the innocent, put the guilty behind bars, and change laws. The team includes a Pulitzer Prize finalist, three members of the nationally renowned ProPublica Local Reporting News, a grant recipient from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, a regional Edward R. Murrow Regional Award winner, top national award recipients from investigative reporters and editors in the National Society of Professional Journalists, and a data journalism specialist with a former reporter and researcher for the Pulitzer Prize winner Better Government Association in Chicago. Working by these teams has already begun, with in-depth reporting on leading causes of death throughout more than a dozen Lee markets, including the Cedar Valley, and a recently published investigation in partnership with ProPublica on a systematic pattern of abuse and mistreatment of mental health and patients in state-run facilities in Illinois. Our investment in high-impact journalism will pay, and already is paying, incredible dividends for the local news audiences we serve, said Mark Chase, Midwest News Director for Lee Enterprises. We built these teams with skilled, proven journalists who know how to hone in on the issues that matter and bring light and justice to circumstances that otherwise wouldn't see the light of day. And here's a subsection that says, the Midwest Region Team. Lauren Cross. Lauren joined Lee Enterprises in 2016 as a cop/breaking news reporter on the Northwest Indiana Public Safety Team, immediately distinguishing herself as a prolific, high-analytic reporter, driving some of the highest user and page view numbers at one of Lee's busiest breaking news markets. Lauren quickly evolved into a high-impact investigative reporter, covering Northwest Indiana's urban core and shining a light on problems plaguing underserved communities. She won top national awards from investigative reporters and editors and the National Society of Professional Journalists for her investigative work uncovering and exposing public corruption that led to a major lead contamination and poisoning issue in East Chicago, Indiana. In 2020, Lauren became the Midwest Special Projects Reporter, helping to guide award-winning investigations of police diversity issues in the Midwest in the midst of widespread civil unrest and rioting. For the past year, Lauren has been the top editor at the Southern Illinoisian in Carbondale and now rejoins the investigative reporting ranks. The next member is Molly Parker, veteran investigative projects reporter at Southern Illinoisian since 2014. Working on second ProPublica investigative reporting fellowship, Molly has specialized in putting spotlight on injustices involving children, families, and the mentally disabled, including a recently published investigation detailing a systemic pattern of abuse at an Illinois state-run inpatient facility. Next person is Annalisa Trofimuk. Previously a projects and investigative reporter for the Bloomington Pantograph, and most recently an investigative reporter and researcher for the Pulitzer Prize-winning Better Government Association in Chicago, Annalisa is completing the final stages in her master's degree in data journalism from DePaul and rejoined Lee's Midwest team as a data specialist. Annalisa already has been coaching and leading data initiatives in newsrooms across the Midwest in her field weeks in her first weeks on the job, including major work on the What's Killing Our Regions project and the Childhood Obesity Initiative. And the last member is Karen Robinson-Jacobs. Most recently, a report from America Fellowship of the St. Louis American with past reporting and editing positions at the Dallas Morning News, Los Angeles Times, and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, expert at putting a white-hot spotlight on investigations surrounding racial injustice and diversity. Karen is already diving in on a major data probe of a police diversity inequity and accountability issues in the Midwest. Now let's move on to Patsy Cline comes alive in hit musical opening September 16th at the Waterloo Community Playhouse. The hit musical Always, Patsy Cline, is a show with a big heart, down-home humor, and plenty of songs by the late country music sweetheart. The Waterloo Community Playhouse production opens at 7 p.m. Friday. Norman Ussery is thrilled to be in the director's chair. He'll be directing his first show since retiring as WCP's executive director in January. This is a show I've been championing for a while. I grew up with a lot of country music around my home. It's a style that I understand, and I've gotten to know some of the country's recording artists along my career path. Country music performers are closer to theater than most pop or rock performers because they're storytellers. Each song is a story, Ussery explained. He finds the heartfelt jukebox musical particularly appealing because it is based on a real-life relationship between legendary country music star Patsy Cline and a fan, Louis Seeger. Cline and the housewife met at a Houston honky-tonk in 1961 and corresponded until Cline's death. She was killed in a plane crash in 1963. Always, Patsy Cline was conceived by and the book written by playwright, director, and producer Ted Swindley. Cassidy Atchison has been cast as Cline and Chloe Ryan Anderson as Seeger. The story is fun and funny. Louise is a real lovable person, but she's aggressive and pushy and full of herself. She went to see Patsy perform live and became a big fan. Patsy was not ego-driven at all. She was just a hard-working country girl with a beautiful voice, Ussery said. Atchison closely resembles Patsy Cline in publicity photos, and it's not just makeup and hair, it's the cheeks. My cheeks look like hers, she said with a laugh. The actor/singer confessed that she was a little intimidated by playing Cline. Initially, she thought that she'd be pretty and preserved and just sing the songs. But delving deeper into Cline's life, she discovered that Patsy was a legend for her time. She had a lot of stuff go wrong in her life, but she stuck with her music and sang these songs that are still so relevant today, Atchison explained. Patsy was a trailblazer for women, one of the first women to break out as a solo artist in the industry. She wasn't as prim and proper as I thought. It's a physically draining show. Atchison has 27 songs, including Crazy, I Fall to Pieces, Sweet Dreams, and Walking After Midnight. Anderson has lengthy monologues and discussions with the audience. Anderson sees something of herself in Louise. She's a major fan of Patsy's, incredibly loyal, can't stop talking, will fight for her friends, and have a good time at the same time. She can be a lady and still make you laugh. She brings out the human side of Patsy. Scenes between Atchison and Anderson are done with the songs. Seven Lonely Days and Blue Moon of Kentucky are among Atchison's favorites in the show. I live for those songs because it's my chance to interact with Chloe, Louise, and we play off each other's energy. She's amazing. Usuri has encouraged Atchison to be honest with her portrayal of Patsy and show a side of the country singer that the public never knew in the early 60s. There was no internet, no cell phones, so people weren't documenting every moment of their lives. I feel like she found a true friend that she could be herself with, Atchison said. Usuri said both performers are front and center for the entire show. Normally, a rehearsal is 2 or 3 or more hours long, but we never go that long because I want them to save their voices and build up the stamina. It's like conditioning an athlete, Usuri explained. Then throw into the mix a live band on stage with lots of byplay between the singer and band, and it's a real workout for everyone. Stage design features 3 main areas. A bandstand that resembles the Grand Ole Opry is at the center stage, and on opposite sides are Louise's kitchen and a sliver of a honky-tonk bar. At 99, Betsy Gotich is the stage manager. She has been a stage manager on countless WCP and Black Hawk Children's Theater shows for more than 50 years. Performances are at 7 p.m. September 16th, 17th, 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, and 2 p.m. September 18th and 25th. Hope Martin Theater is located in Waterloo Center for the Arts at 225 Commercial Street. Order tickets online at wcpbhct.org by calling 319-291-4494 or in person at the WCP box office from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. For group orders, call 319-235-0367. Now let's go on to Pulitzer Prize-winning author to speak at UNI as part of Distinguished Lecture Series. Presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author John McCam will make an appearance on the University of Northern Iowa's campus later this month. McCam will present Finding Hope Through the Lessons of Yesterday, September 19th, as a part of the university's Joy Cole Corning Distinguished Lecture Series. The 7 p.m. event will be held at the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center, Great Hall, 8201 Dakota Street. As difficult as the present is, the American past is the story of challenges overcome, crises resolved, and progress made, notes an online promotion for the event. In this nonpartisan speech, John McCam walks the audience throughout moments that have seen interactable, which can include the influenza pandemic of 1918, the battle against polio, FDR's reaction to the first days of the Depression, Winston Churchill's decision to fight off against Hitler, the Cuban Missile Crisis, to offer lessons for leaders and how to endure and prevail when everything appears hopeless. The series, established in 2001 by Corning, an alumna and former Iowa Lieutenant Governor, brings to campus nationally and internationally renowned leaders in the arts, business, education, government, and the judiciary. The series provides students with an understanding of what constitutes leadership across disciplines and helps them discover how people become leaders in their fields, according to a UNI news release. McCam is described by the university as one of America's most prominent public intellectuals, with a depth of knowledge about politics, history, religion, and current affairs. He has the unique ability to bring historical context to the issues and events impacting daily lives. The author of several number one New York Times bestsellers, McCam has written acclaimed books about Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, George H.W. Bush, and civil rights icon John Lewis. A member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a fellow of the Society of American Historians, McCam is a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, where he holds the Rogers Chair and the American Presidency. His latest book, And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle, will be published in the fall of 2022. Admission is free and tickets are required. Tickets are available at the Gallagher Blue Door and Performing Arts Center and at McLeod Center ticket offices or by phone at 319-273-4849. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 11th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Daniel Lee Wolfe. Daniel Lee Wolfe, 49, of Waterloo, died Sunday, September 4th at his home. He was born March 3rd, 1973, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Gary Wolfe and Janann Preby. He graduated from Expo High School. He was most recently employed as a forklift operator with International Paper. Dan is survived by his two cats, Punk and Miss Piggy, mother Jean of Evansdale, a sister and brother-in-law, Don and Sean Aubrey of Cedar Falls, a half-brother, Bruce Kane of Texas, and step-siblings, Anita Dowler of Minnesota and Ed Preby, and Valerie Herman of Waterloo. His nephew, Cade Aubrey of Cedar Falls, and nieces, Ayanna Snell and Siami Snell of Waterloo, Shelby Snell of Washington, Nicole Cowan, and great-nephews and nieces and niece, Braxton, Caden, Barrick, and Noralee Cowan of Olwine. He was preceded in death by his father, Gary Wolfe, and Robert Preby, and grandmother, Blanche Clemenson. A family-directed celebration of life will be held September 17th at 2 p.m. at 127 Madison Street, Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to his mother, Jeanne Preby, 701 East End, Evansdale, Iowa. Online condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. A special thanks to his mother for dedicating the last year to taking care of Dan's needs and keeping him company. Barbara Ann McGovern. Barbara Ann McGovern was born on April 1st, 1950 in Waterloo, Iowa, the daughter of Thomas and Helen Scarborough. Bar, as referred to by her siblings, was the second oldest of five. She excelled in school, attending McKinstry Junior High and graduating from East Waterloo High School in 1968. Barb was known throughout her life to have excellent handwriting, which was taught by her mother. She had a love of music, playing the clarinet in the East High Band. Barb worked at City Hall and Walker's Shoe Store in downtown Waterloo as Mr. Walker's personal secretary. Barb strived to build a successful career at a time when the path for women to do so wasn't the easiest. She did just that. Barb began her studies and graduated from Kirkwood Community College. She was hired at John Deere in Waterloo and gave 30 years of quality work before retiring April 30th, 2009, as manager of the systems. Barbara was a true role model in every sense of its meaning, especially to young females. She was a strikingly tall, beautiful woman who was professional, confident, and dressed to the nines. Barbara met Arthur Art McGovern after being set up on a blind date. Sharing their first dance to the song For the Good Times by Ray Price will be remembered always. They married on July 17th, 1971 at the Blessed Sacrament Church and were happily married 51 years. Barb often referred to Art as Artie Tom. Barb and Art had two boys that they were extremely proud of, Jason and Nicholas. Barb was invested in her boys' future, making sure both received a quality education and pursued various interests to the fullest. Barb loved to travel and encourage her sons to see the world. She planned numerous summer vacations that entailed long cross-country trips in their full-sized van. Barb grew from being a great mother to being a best friend to both Jason and Nick. She was instrumental in who her sons married and enjoyed gaining two beautiful daughters. Barb welcomed every grandson she had with love and hugs. To both Jason and Nick, Barb was a queen. Barb's love of music only grew stronger with time. Although she loved a variety of music, Motown Records was her favorite. Barb enjoyed social gatherings, nightlife with close friends, and loved to dance. She will be remembered for requesting the song New York, New York by Frank Sinatra and handpicking relatives and friends to begin a kickline dance with her. Barb loved dancing to the Rod Stewart song Hot Legs. Art and Bob both enjoyed the song Forever Young and eventually saw Rod Stewart in concert. Barb loved playing pool and cards. She loved flowers and enjoyed gardening in her free time. Barb loved decorating for upcoming holidays and spending those holidays with family and friends. She had a phenomenal sense for fashion, and when Barb went shopping, it was an all-day event. Barb loved animals. After marriage, Barb found a lost chihuahua, Josie, and convinced Art to adopt her. At separate times, they had two cocker spaniels, Mandy and Lexi, that Barb adored. Barb will always be remembered for her infectious laugh. This well-remembered laugh lit up the room. Barb loved her family greatly. She took great pride in being able to help care for her mother as she aged. She loved her siblings and all her nieces and nephews. Barb had a gift for offering advice, guidance, and friendship. Barb was extremely accepting of all people, wherever they came from, and enjoyed learning about people's backgrounds and experiences. Barb demanded best out of those she loved, and she could bring out the best in everyone she loved. Barb had a true love of angels. She had many angels throughout her home and in her gardens. Barb played a large angel in front of her family's home every Christmas that she shined a bright light on. Barb was truly an angel and will forever be an angel. Barbara passed away September 2nd, 2022, with Jason and Nick by her side. She is preceded in death by her parents, Thomas and Helen Scarborough, her husband, Arthur Thomas McGovern, friend, Janine Brasher, and grandson, Connor McGovern. Barb is survived by her two sons, Jason McGovern of Bloomington, Minnesota, and Nick McGovern of Waterloo, four grandchildren, Zane and Luke McGovern, and Brett and Brandy McGovern, four siblings, Skip Scarborough of Plainfield, Illinois, Mike Scarborough of Parkville, Missouri, Larry Scarborough of Big Bear Lake, California, and Cook Olson of Papillion, Nebraska. Barbara's inspiration will forever live on forever. She is now flying with all the angels. A burial service is being planned for 2 p.m. on September 24th, 2022, Mount Olivet Cemetery, 3912 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Following the burial service, a celebration of life will be held from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Brown Derby Ballroom in downtown Waterloo, 618 Sycamore Street. Parrot and Wood is handling arrangements. The phone number is 319-232-3235. Now, let's move over to the sports section, starting with, it's a Cyclone State. College football. Iowa State nabs Cy Hawk Trophy for the first time since 2014. Iowa State wide receiver Xavier Hutchinson drew the matchup he wanted and expected. One man to beat, one monumental catch to make. His quarterback, Hunter Deckers, set his feet, fired into the end zone, and Hutchinson did the deed, clutching an 8-yard touchdown pass with 8 minutes and 47 seconds left that ultimately, if shakily, held up as the Cyclones outlasted Iowa 10-7 Saturday while snapping a 6-game skid in the Cy-Hawk series at Kinnick Stadium. They did cover zero like they normally do on a big play in the end zone, Hutchinson said. Hunter believed in me one more time. I'm just happy that I could make that play for him. Hutchinson, who notched a game-high 11 catches for 99 yards, made the play that capped the drive that gave ISU its first victory since 2014 against its in-state rivals. That drive, following an Iowa fumble forced by Cyclone senior linebacker Orion Vance at the goal line, not only spanned 99 yards, it consumed 11 minutes and 49 seconds of the clock. ISU converted 6 third down chances on the drive, including the Deckers to Hutchinson touchdown that came on 3rd and goal from the Iowa 8-yard line. Great growth from Hunter, ISU head coach Matt Campbell said of Deckers, who completed 25 of 38 passes for 184 yards. The touchdown and 2 interceptions. Again, we'll find out when the bullets fly and you're in front of the lights and that the lights come on and it's not pretty. Who are you when your back's against the wall? I think we found out a little bit more about who we are and certainly who we've got the ability to grow into. Tailback Jarrell Brock added 100 rushing yards for the Cyclones, who outgained the Hawkeyes 313 yards to 150. Still, Iowa had a chance at the end after an ISU offsides penalty and an unsportsmanlike conduct call, but Iowa kicker Aaron Blom's potential game-tying field goal sailed wide left from 48 yards away as time expired. I mean, you've just got to keep playing, Deckers, said Deckers, who is 2-0 as the Cyclones' starting quarterback. That means playing through 3 turnovers, including a Brock fumble at the goal line, and 2 blocked punts, the first of which led to Iowa's only points in the first quarter. But ISU also forced 4 turnovers against a Hawkeye team that had built a 9-0 edge in turnover margin in the past 5 wins in the series. Ultimately, along with the drive, helped the Cyclones finally prevail again. Barely. The Cy-Hawk Trophy will reside in Ames for at least one season again for the first time in 8 years. Because of the drive, because of clutch plays, and because of a missed field goal that almost miraculously forced overtime. Not a pretty football game, Campbell said. It's a game of imperfection, and I give our kids a lot of credit. Obviously, it's a hard place to play, a very good football program, and a football tram. And for our kids to have the character and resiliency to keep playing, those are things that are great traits that hopefully will continue to serve us as we continue to grow. As for the 3 turnovers forced, lots of players contribute to that breakthrough. Linebacker Gary Vaughn forced a fumble that defensive end Will McDonald collected in the first half. Cornerback TJ Tampa tipped a pass that turned into a first half interception for linebacker Colby Reeder. Add in the Vance forced fumble at the goal line, which reserve linebacker Kendall Jackson recovered that preceded the drive, and you have the makings of a satisfying, if imperfect, victory. A lot of good, a lot of bad, one huge rivalry game win. It's a special rivalry, and yet it's still the second game of our season, Campbell said. From our end, if we let this shape up rather than define us, we can use what we learned today and grow from it. Now on to another college football article. Northern Iowa falls in back-and-forth battle with North Dakota. Northern Iowa responded to a big blow after a big blow by North Dakota Saturday. In the end, the Panthers didn't have an answer for Fighting Hawk quarterback Tommy Schuster, who made play after play to lift UND to a 29-27 victory over the Panthers in the Missouri Valley Football Conference opener for both teams at the Alaris Center. It is disappointing to lose that one, UNI quarterback Theo Day said after throwing for 334 yards and a touchdown. I think we had every opportunity to win it, and a couple of costly mistakes hurt us from scoring. It hurts, but I think we're going to be okay. In a back-and-forth game, Schuster used his legs and arms to convert big third downs for UND as the Fighting Hawks bled out the final 6 minutes and 51 seconds of the game after UNI had pulled to within 29-27 on a 72-yard bomb from Theo Day to Dion McShane. The biggest play of all of them came on a 3rd and 10 from the UNI 40, with just more than 90 seconds left. The Panthers put on a great rush, but Schuster scrambled left and then found Garrett Mang for a 20-yard gain for a first down, and UND was able to run the clock out. Too many errors as a team, myself included, linebacker Spencer Colavier said. I need to be a better leader for our team. This is a tough one to swallow. Holding them to 7 points in the first half and not really stopping them in the second half. Schuster finished 20 of 23 for 275 yards and a pair of scores, and he rushed 7 times for only 11 yards. He extended a lot of flares. He made a lot of plays, a lot of great plays, UNI head coach Mark Farley said. And it was a whale of a second half as both teams delivered haymaker after haymaker. Leading 10-7, UNI took the opening kick in the second half and drove all the way inside the UND 10. But a sack on second down set the Panthers back, and Matthew Cook came on to boot a 30-yard field goal for a 13-7 lead. The Fighting Hawks came flying right back, taking advantage of a pass interference penalty against UNI to erase a Bryce Flatter interception and extend its initial drive of the second half. Schuster then hit Bo Belquist for a 39-yard touchdown pass on a deep fly that put UND up 14-13 with 7 minutes left in the third. UND extended its lead after a 47-yard field goal missed by Cook. A pair of third-down conversions and a 22-yard pass from Schuster to Garrett Mag moved the Fighting Hawks to UNI 13. 2 plays later, the former Panther Tyler Hoosman scored on a 6-yard run, and Schuster added a 2-point run to make it 22-13. The Panthers, however, didn't blink. Passes of 11 to Schnee and 22 to Deion McShane put UNI into UND territory, and then Dom Williams broke loose for his second long touchdown run of the game from 46 yards to make it 22-20, with 13 minutes and 6 seconds left in the game. A 46-yard run by Hoosman led to a 6-yard Schuster touchdown run, with to push the score back to 29-20 with 7 minutes and 8 seconds left in the game. UNI didn't blink. Day dropped back, rolled right, and lofted a pass as far as he could throw it, and landed it in the hands of Deion McShane in stride for a 72-yard score, and it was a one-score game just 17 seconds later. That is just a great play call, Day said. That is what comes down to it. I didn't expect that play call necessarily, given the situation, but when I looked out there, I knew there would be a chance to beat them deep. I'm just unhappy I was able to get it off, and we were able to score there. McShane finished with 6 catches for 157 yards, and Sam Schnee had 8 grabs for 109 yards. Dom Williams rushed for 103 yards on 8 carries and 2 scores. UND exploded out of the gates as CJ Sigil returned an opened kick inside territory, and the Fighting Hawks caught a break when Sigil fumbled on the return by recovering it at the Panthers' 41. UND took no time to score as plays of 22 and 18 put them on the doorstep of the end zone, and on a 3rd and 3 play, Schuster found tight end Adam Zalvani for a 3-yard touchdown just 1 minute and 33 seconds into the game. After a trade of punts, the Panthers put together their first scoring drive as Day and Schnee went to work. Schnee had 4 catches as the Panthers drove to the Fighting Hawks 9 before a penalty stalled the drive and UNI had to settle for Matthew Cook. 29-yard field goal as the first quarter buzzer sounded. UND drove into UNI territory after Cook's field goal, but Wu Governor picked up a Schuster inside the Panthers' 10 and returned it to 32. UNI caught a break on its first play after the pick as Vance McShane fumbled after a 6-yard run. Fortunately, Panther tight end Lane Pryor won a scrum for the ball to keep it in UNI's possession. A 9-yard third down pass from Day to McShane got you and I moving, and then another third down pass, this one for 9 yards, to Schnee got the Panthers to the Fighting Hawk 41. On the next play, Dom Williams busted through a humongous hole, broke a pair of arm tackles on his way to a 41-yard touchdown and a 10-7 Panthers lead. UND drove deep into the UNI territory as the first half winded down, but the Fighting Hawks missed a 45-yard field goal wide right as the half ended. Moving on to a different but related article, 5 takeaways from UNI's 29-27 loss to North Dakota. Number 1. The new offense is just getting started. Offensive play callers Bodie Reeder and Ryan Clayton has something cooking, and it's a good thing. The run game and pass game both had their moments Saturday. The Panthers in particular were very efficient on third down, where they converted more than 50% of their third downs. And finally, the up-tempo system UNI has wanted to run may have finally arrived. Lesson number 2. Run game is going. Dom Williams showed breakaway speed on both of his touchdown runs Saturday. The second, a 47-yard sprint, saw Williams bust through a hole even with 2 Fighting Hawks defenders, but he just proceeded to pull away. He and Vance McShane are going to be a dynamic duo in the backfield. Number 3. Sam Schnee turning into UNI's Swiss Army knife. The 5'10", 195-pound junior from Dubuque is becoming Theo Day's go-to target in tight situations. Schnee had 3 third-down catches for first down in the first half. A year after making 29 grabs, including 5 touchdown receptions, Schnee is on pace to haul in more than 50 passes this fall. Number 4. Defensive struggles. That group took a step forward Saturday, but in the fourth quarter, UND found traction. At halftime, UNI allowed just 28 yards and on 15 carries, and it went just 63 on 23 through quick 3 quarters. But as the game wore on, UND picked up the pace and helped bleed the clock, and former Panthers Tyler Hoosman finished with more than 100 yards rushing and a touchdown. UND finished with 438 yards on 66 plays, and Tommy Schuster was 21 of 25 in the game. Dion McShane shines, the senior from Freeport, Illinois. The senior from Freeport, Illinois, set career highs in receiving yards at 157 and career-long reception 72 yards in the game. His 157-yard game gives him back-to-back 100 yards receiving games to start the season. Now let's go on to some high school sports with high school volleyball. Osage wins home tourney. Cedar Falls finishes 4-1. Osage's volleyball program hosted its weekend tournament on Saturday morning with a loaded field that featured 5 teams ranked inside the top 15 in the latest rankings. As the day went along, it became evident that the Class 3A No. 10 Green Devils weren't going to be denied on their home floor. They swept 3A No. 13 Forest City, 4A No. 7 Waverly-Shellrock, 5A No. 3 Cedar Falls, and 1A No. 14 Dunkerton and New Hampton to go a perfect 5-0 on the afternoon and claim the winner's plaque. Anytime you got a tournament like this with so many ranked teams, you expect a battle every time out, Osage head coach Brian Tabbert said. You prepare for those 3 set battles. To sweep everybody, you just feel amazing. So proud of the girls. The Tigers finished 4-1 on the day. The Raiders went 3-2 as they knock off WSR, Forest City, and New Hampton all in 3 sets and nearly pushed Cedar Falls to a third set. After losing 3 in a row, Gohawks rebounded with victories over New Hampton and Forest City. The Chickasaws swept the Indians, putting their record at 4-1 and 0-5 respectively. In 10 sets, Osage went 9-2. And only gave up at least 18 points once. The first set against Cedar Falls was a nip and tuck until the Green Devils found late offense. They started a run in the second set to go up 14-2 and scored the last 7 points. Forest City struggled much that day with serve, receive, and passing in the system. It went from 4-0 entering the morning to head back to the top of Iowa West action at 4-5. The Indians pushed Dunkerton to a third set but couldn't close the deal. Waverly Shorrock was coming off of a 1-4 showing at the Shirley Ryan tournament last weekend in Mount Vernon and came out flat in the early going as it was nipped by the Raiders in three sets and then swept by Cedar Falls and Osage. Dunkerton, despite dropping in the 1A rankings and losing on Thursday night to Waterloo Christian, hung with the big schools. It was 2 points away from playing a third set with the Tigers before they went on a late run to hold on for the sweep. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 11th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.